This is Betty DeShong Midor. How to prepare for the millennium. April 11th, 1997.
Hello, and thank you for inviting me to Seattle. It's just a real pleasure to come up here and to watch the changing terrain as you fly over these gorgeous mountains. You know, we don't have any mountains in California. We have Mount Shasta. I shouldn't say that. And we do have the Rockies. But there's something about these sentinels that just stand out in the middle of nowhere that's very, very beautiful and impressive. It's very nice to be here. I thought they said they didn't have nice weather in Seattle. I don't understand your reputation. Okay, some time back I was reading Jung's book, Ion, and I found in a little tiny footnote somewhere in there where Jung was talking about the precession of the equinoxes, and he said that the new millennium... Ion was written in the 50s, somewhere in there. I forget exactly when, but it was one of Jung's last books. And this little footnote said that the new age would start. There's a difference in when exactly it starts, depending on how you calculate. And I don't understand this at all, but I'll read it to you. It starts somewhere between 2000 and 2200. If you calculate from star O, the new millennium will actually begin in the year 2154. But if you calculate from star A, now I gather that that astrologers debate whether you use star O or star A, the millennium starts at the spring equinox of 1997. And that was, I read that several years ago. I thought, my gosh, that's just a couple of years away. Well, actually, we're past it now because it was, I think it actually took place instead of March 21st, I think it was March 20th this year. And I kept saying this to my Jungian colleagues, and they were kind of like, what are you talking about, you know? But Jung was very up on these things, and so I want to just begin. That was so startling to me that we stepped over into the new millennium possibly last month. This was all new to me, that the way you calculate the millennium of the Platonic month, as it is called, a Platonic month is 2,143 years long. And what it indicates is in which of the constellations the sun rises at the spring equinox. I hope none of you knew this, because this was such news to me, I was quite startled by it. So for the last 2,000 years, the sun has been rising at the spring equinox in the constellation of Pisces. And beginning by, depending on how you calculate it, and this is not exact because this isn't astronomy, this is more astrology. At the beginning of the new age, the sun will rise, of course, at the equinox in the constellation of Aquarius. Now, I want to show you some slides of what is actually happening. So maybe we should turn the lights off. Now, let me see here. This you may recognize, this is from a wonderful book that, instead of showing the constellation, draws a picture of what it's supposed to look like. I think I can move over here. I'll just take this little box with me. This is the constellation of Pisces here, with the lines drawn between it, between the stars. And it is known as the constellation of the two fishes. And this, the new constellation we're moving into, is the constellation of Aquarius, the water carrier. This is his vessel, and this is the water pouring out, and this is the water carrier himself. Now, this strip, which is going to be very hard for you to see, is the procession of the constellations that in which the sun has risen throughout time and will continue to rise at the spring equinox. And you can see here is Pisces. I'm sorry, I really can't see this very well. And here is Aquarius. So that they come one after another. And you may recognize, here's the lion, and here's the crab, here are the twins. So after Aquarius, we get into, I can't see what that is, but it's written on here, just a minute. Oh dear. Who knows what... It must be Capricorn. Yes, okay. Now, why do I keep going back to Aquarius? Here's the deal. Here's Earth going around the sun in the middle of this picture. And as you can see, as the Earth moves from December to March to June to September, this is the Earth's orbit, that it would appear the sun would be rising at a different point on the zodiac. Do you see that? Here's Virgo, the lion, the crab, the bull, the ram. Here are the fishes. Now, when this particular book from which I took the picture was written, it was written in about 1978, the sun was rising clearly at the spring equinox in the constellation of the fishes. It's not that it rises in that, but it appears that that's where it's rising. And now we have moved, even since 1978, so that the sun is much more over toward the constellation of Aquarius. Do you kind of get the picture of that? It's a little bit difficult to see, but and I can't explain it astronomically, but some of you probably can understand that better than I can. And then here is a picture of the sky during certain times of the year, and I took this picture out because here, the zodiac is this circle here, the dotted line circle. And here's Pisces. You can see the two fish. And here's Aquarius, the water carrier. And you can see how close together that they actually are. And then the other constellations on the zodiac stay on that circle. So it's not every constellation in the sky, it's just the constellations on the zodiac that we're concerned with. Now, I'm just going to leave that up there for a minute because I want to show you some other slides. Why is this even important? And I think what how Jungian psychology has helped us to understand what the constellations are. It's not that those constellations were always seen in the shapes and forms that we now see them. But the important and crucial element is that the human psyche forever has done this incredibly interesting thing, and that is to project onto the heavens. And we have evidence that even in the Paleolithic, I mean, I don't know why we should even be surprised, but it's wonderful that we have evidence that in the Paleolithic, at that time, the orienting celestial body that kept, that sort of made sense of what was going on to Paleolithic people was the moon. And this is really the first evidence that we have. Some of you may be familiar with Alexander Marshak's study of these strange carvings on bones. Marshak was a research fellow at the Peabody Museum of Archaeology at Harvard, and he first deciphered these strange markings on bones of ivory of incredible antiquity, and these bones had puzzled scholars for years. After examining hundreds of bones, mammoth tusks, reindeer antlers, elephant tusks, Marshak confirmed his intuition that these were calendars, noting the precession of the moon's phases over months and sometimes even years. And I want to tell you about Marshak just so that you realize that this is part of the human psyche that we project into the heavens. I'm going to flip another slide here, and I can see. I keep doing that. Now, this is the this is a figure which you may be familiar with. She's called Venus of Locelle. And on the horn, which she holds in her hand, are 13 little marks. And Marshak reminded us that the 13 is the number of crescent moons, and there are 13 crescents on her horn, 13 crescents that make up an observational lunar year. 13 is also the number of days from birth to the first crescent, to just before the days of the mature full moon. Now, Marshak, the scientist that he was, nevertheless interpreted these pieces as symbols that had a traditional story and use. In other words, these carving that was related to celestial bodies, in this case particularly the moon, was related to a world mythology, he felt, that was present in Paleolithic times. Now, this is one of the bones, pieces of bone that Marshak found. And this is a particularly interesting one. It's almost like a labyrinth. It weaves around. It starts here, weaves back and around, and depicts the phases of the moon. He developed a very elaborate schema to read these bones that he found. How many marks denoted what phase of the moon? And there would be some of the bones and tusks and so on would hold like 6 months of moon calendar. And he could tell that the marks were made at different times because he could show that different instruments were used to make the markings and that they're not all made by at one time by one artist or whatever, one carving person. These are just examples of these strange bones that showed up in archaeologists' digs from the Paleolithic. So this focus of the earliest human communities on the moon again, was the basic underpinning of their orientation, mythologically, spiritually, materially, philosophically, and culturally. And there's a lot of evidence of that, that from the Paleolithic and even, and of course, on into the Neolithic. So all life revolved around or reflected the swelling and diminishing of the moon. That most basic oriented light in the sky entered the bodies of the women, touching them with its divine, numinous essence in an intimate way. Each month, at a particular phase, some say at the dark of the moon, the women all bled in synchrony. If you are a woman and you've ever been in a dormitory, or if you have daughters, you know that your periods synchronize very easily and quickly, and there's a lot of scientific studies of that. So for the moon to be the orienting light in the sky, and then this awesome bleeding, this all became part of the story. Human women are the only mammals whose menstrual periods synchronize exactly with the 29.5-day cycle of the moon. Gorillas and monkeys have different cycles, but human women, I mean, that's pretty astonishing, isn't it? That our menstrual cycle is exactly synchronized with the moon. So this is just an example from way, way back to help us understand why the millennium has any relevance at all now. This is a drawing of that very first stone that you saw, and you can see the different shapes that denote different phases of the moon. Okay, now we can turn the lights on and turn off the slide projector. It's not a surprise to us that astronomy had such a big role in helping humans orient to the world. There's evidence from Neolithic and Bronze Age of the Maya at Chichen Itza, if some of you have been there to see the observatory. And certainly the Babylonians had a very elaborate way to observe what was happening in the stars and the planets. So we have trouble because, you know, we're modern Westerners and we separate science from mythology. But that wasn't true in those days, that science and mythology all worked together so that the sky became this giant Rorschach, and on it we projected the meaning of our lives and the meaning of the universe, and it was an orienting factor. So the movement of the spring point across the zodiac has been known for as long as humans were observing the stars. So the rich storehouse of the imagination read meaningful stories into the movement of the stars, of the zodiac, and the equinox across the zodiac. What we discover in that, or what the human beings discovered in the reading the zodiac, were the dominance of the unconscious, that is, the gods. So looking at the zodiac, the stars and the moon and the planets became the gods. And we projected a whole theory of human character onto the zodiac. These early people saw in the stars representations of certain natural constants of the unconscious psyche, the ways emotions and imaginal elements of the psyche behave. So these were typical, predictable elements. So now, what is happening as we move into the age of Aquarius? We've had a particular projection for the last 2,000 years on the constellation of Pisces. the spring point, that is, that's the day when the sun rises in the at the equinox, the spring point entered Pisces at about the beginning of our era. And if you remember what the two fish looked like, it first rose in that in the northerly or easterly fish. And as we saw, the northerly fish is joined to the westerly fish by a band of faint stars called a commissure. So just remember that because it comes up later. The spring point moved across its southern edge and entered the tail of the second fish roughly in the 16th century at the time of the Reformation. And at the time of the Reformation, there was a great schism in the church, which was extraordinarily important for the history of Western symbolism. The spring point has moved across the southern edge of the second fish, and as I said, will enter Aquarius in the third millennium between 1997 and 2200, somewhere in there. We don't know exactly when. The change of consciousness in the 16th century was very evident in as the Reformation unfolded. Before that, there had been these beautiful Gothic churches with their tall steeples, the Gothic striving upward. And that was replaced by a horizontal movement in the 16th century outwards, so that there the dominant event were the voyages of discovery and the conquest of nature. So what had been an upward, if you think about the two fish, Jung called them the hostile brothers. They're two and they're split apart, so they're like the opposites in the sky, or at least that's what we can conveniently project onto them. So in the 16th century, the sun rose in the second fish, which was connected more, which became connected more to the non-spiritual, to the horizontal movement out of discovery and the control of nature. Man's spiritual and moral development moved in a direction that grew more and more obviously anti-Christian. This is from Jung. The spirit became non-spiritual, and the vitalizing archetype degenerated into rationalism, intellectualism, and doctrinarism, all of which lead straight to the tragedy of modern times. This is Jung. Now hanging over our heads like the sword of Damocles. So Jung saw these two fish as the split that occurred in that 2,000-year period. The present age must come to terms drastically with the facts as they are, with the absolute opposition that is not only tearing the world asunder politically, but has planted a schism in the human heart. We need to find our way back to the original living spirit, which, because of its ambivalence, is also a mediator and uniter of opposites, an idea that preoccupied the alchemist for many centuries. Sometimes Jung talked about the two fish of Pisces as the Christ and the Antichrist, or at least the hostile brothers, and that story got lived out in the first half of that 2,000-year period, actually up to the 16th century, and then that the time since the 16th century has been a great leveling of spirituality, where spirituality has diminished and science has become our God. Now we have a new symbol ushering in the new age. And the problem of the new age, Jung says, is the problem of bringing those opposites back together, of healing that splitting. He's not saying that's what's going to happen in the new age, but that will be our problem, that is what we are faced with. So that, as I think about that, it really makes sense in terms of what we have learned about human psychology, it's like saying that for that 2,000-year period, that the main psychological defense or the main psychological orientation that humans developed was the defense of splitting and projection. So that we've learned since the beginning of this century a lot about splitting, psychological splitting, and projection. We've learned that through things like psychotherapy or analysis or just self-study, that you can get aware of what you're projecting out, of how you're splitting off particularly the worst parts of ourselves. We split that off into other people. And we're learning gradually how to take back those shadowy elements and own them as our own. And it isn't just the bad stuff that we project out. We idealize, you know, we project our idealized images onto people, onto institutions. And gradually, through self-study, we learn that we can bring that back. So I think that we are developing the tools here at the end of the millennium that will help us to heal the natural and normal and sometimes pathological, but splitting is a natural and normal part of human development, and we're learning to deal with that. You know, projection is just an absolutely essential part of the process by which the archetypes assume a determinable shape. That before you incorporate or understand an archetypal image in yourself, it almost always is projected out at first. So it's just an essential process that we go through. And the problem in the new age will be, hopefully, to learn how to develop to the point that we can take back the projections and widen the circumference of who we are as individuals by being able to take back the projections. There's an interesting statement by James Grotstein, who is actually a Freudian psychoanalyst, who wrote a wonderful book on splitting and projective identification, where he goes through into this whole process of psychological splitting. He says that the neurological basis for splitting we see when a baby is 3 to 4 months old, the deep cerebral commissures, now there's that word commissure again, which unite the two cerebral hemispheres, begin to myelinate, not until 3 or 4 months. They begin to come together. So it's almost like the human brain is made for splitting and projection. Grotstein connects this neurophysiological event with the baby's beginning awareness of its separate existence at 3 to 4 months. And those of you who have been around babies know what happens at 3 to 4 months. It's very different. Melanie Klein locates also, she says, a very important event happens at the 3rd or 4th month, which she calls moving into the depressive position, where the baby understands itself to be separate from the mother. It's unfortunate terminology, but that's what she calls it. And Margaret Mahler, who's another person who studied children extensively, calls this the hatching phase, about the 5th month. So this slow coming together of the hemispheres in the brain is necessary to manage binocularization. And it's just interesting that this matches the way we see the stars, particularly the constellation of Pisces. There's another story about splitting and projection that I like a lot that comes from the Navajo. In that myth, in the original Navajo myth, First Man, who was one of the main gods, was inside the original Hogan, the archetypal Hogan, and he was making plans to endow all natural phenomena with what he called their inner forms. And these beings that he then placed in all natural phenomena had human form. So a human inner form was given to all natural phenomena. And these inner forms later became the holy people. And I puzzled, well, why didn't he give grass form? Why did it have a human form? And my speculation is that this is about how we project, we see the divine in matter. And it's the human consciousness that the Navajo had this wisdom to see that it's human consciousness that sees the divine in matter. So he called it human form. One of the principal rituals that had to do with the task of revealing projections, with seeing what projections are, was the sacred marriage ritual, which occurred in many, many countries and cultures. Marie-Louise von Franz says that the sacred marriage is about the uniting of these torn asunder psychic opposites. The divine marriage is an archetypal image intended to heal deep psychic dissociation. And her studies reveal that the sacred marriage would blossom in a culture whenever human consciousness had become too far removed from its natural basis. And such reconciliation rites were instituted for the purpose of healing. They generally culminated in the motif of the divine marriage. It seems to me like we're in one of those periods now where where Jung's whole psychology is based on the image of the sacred marriage, really, of the conjunctio, of the mysterious coming together of masculine and feminine. And this is the archetype that he says will dominate the age that we're coming into. That was the introduction. I want to flip now into talking about what this looks like in modern times, and tell you a couple of dreams and talk about this goddess Inanna, who was a goddess who really held both sides together many thousands of years ago. But this is this story is of a modern woman who was a client of mine, and she came one day early in our work, and I happened to be wearing a yellow sweater and black slacks, and she just gasped when she saw me, because the night before she'd had a terrible nightmare of a black and yellow snake crawling threateningly toward her. Made me feel great. So many years we worked together, and with many ups and downs, and even journeys into psychosis and just dreadful dreams, but work and work and work she did, working on her the images that came up in her dreams and the terrible wounding that she had had as a child. And so I want to tell you one of the very last dreams that she had, where the snake comes back. And to me, this is an example of, you know, of integrating this incredibly powerful split-off stuff that looks like a snake in our dreams. It's very powerful archetypal stuff. And what do you do with that? How do you ever get it to a manageable size? But this was a late, late dream. She's standing on a cliff over the ocean. I'm speaking in her voice. I see a huge wave coming. We, her husband and her, are in some danger and run away from the edge. I see people down on the beach and worry about them. That's the first scene. Now in the second scene, she's down on the beach. The people are okay. They're having a barbecue. They are natives in loincloths, barbecuing a huge snake cut into pieces. They say the salt water was necessary to give the snake flavor and to cook it properly. So that to me is just a beautiful example of how years and years of psychological work can reduce this very threatening, overwhelming image of the unconscious, which did overwhelm her at times, into manageable, edible food. And it's interesting about the salt water, because salt is one of the, in alchemy, is one of the three main elements. It has to do with the feminine principle, and so it's like the snake had to be dipped in the salt water of the ocean for it to have its flavor, to have its value, to have its, you know, to be delicious as you face this horrible dark stuff that we encounter in our psyches. The remarkable thing about the goddess Inanna is that she embodies and embraces both this horrible darkness of a huge yellow and black snake that's completely threatening, and she also embraces the light and the goodness of the other side. She's the only major goddess that I know of. I know she's the only goddess in the Sumerian pantheon who carries paradox in that way. And as Jung has talked about the image of the New Age, the problem being the problem of the union of opposites, this is our job, sort of, in the New Age, to be able to encounter this tremendous darkness that we carry and gradually, like my client did, to make it into edible, palatable, digestible food that can feed the soul, really. The poems that I'm just going to read you some excerpts from these poems, and they're poetry of a high priestess named Inhedwana, who lived in Sumer in 2300 BC, and she lived maybe 200 or 300 years after writing the Sumerian cuneiform script. Became full enough to write literature. And she's the first person that we have who actually signed a piece of literature, so we know that a human person wrote this. And we have quite a bit of her work, actually. So she's really the first poet in the world, the first of record. I'm sure there were poets but who didn't know how to write, but she's the first poet of record. She happened to be the daughter of the king, Sargon, and he appointed her sometime late in his reign to be the high priestess in Ur. And she was the high priestess of the moon god, speaking of the moon, in Ur. But she was clearly a devotee of Inanna. Inanna was her personal deity. And this is an example of what it's like what the opposites are like that we're facing. This is some of her, Inanna's horrendous, these long poems that Inhedwana wrote to Inanna, even though she was high priestess of the moon god. Inanna actually was the daughter of the moon couple, Nanna and Ningal, so she was the daughter of the moon. And this is a song that Inhedwana sings to her. In the wide step, the silent glare of noon, she turns to black and shrouded light. She blurs the eyes so friend's face changes shape to foe. She shouts from the faraway step so fertile field shifts to arid waste. Her yowl, like Ishkur's thunderclap and windy howl, shakes bodies, makes all flesh quake. Who dares oppose her undisputed deadly fray? Who dares behold her savage fighting, weapons play, that floods the earth with rage, washes everything away? Mistress Plow, the vacant wasteland split beneath your tooth. Before you, the high-flown proud bend wily necks and strain against your truth. Works of her proud heart, the queen alone creates them. Most exalted of the assembly, she sits on the honored throne, spread out right and left. With a stretch of her defaming hand, she crushes the mountain to garbage, scattering the trash from dawn to dark. With mighty stones she pelts and the mountain like a clay pot crumbles. With her might she melts the mountain into a vat of sheep fat. She is Inanna, bearer of happiness, whose strapping command, hip dagger in hand, spread radiance over the land. Fish dragged from the deep in her stretched out net never will slip through. Birds trapped in her nimble cast thrash in the fine-eyed mesh. What she has crushed to powder never will rise up. The scent of fear stains her robe. She wears the carved-out ground plan of heaven and earth. So I don't know what comes up for you listening to that, you know, the what kind of a reality that energy that's called Inanna depicts. She's not just horrible. She has her good side too. She's called Great Mother Cow. She's all gods, all heaven and earth call you Great Mother Cow. So she's nourishing and giving. Scarcely lift your eyes, the gods, open-mouthed, attend. In your dwelling, the great gods stand, saying sweet prayers, and praise your dreadful brilliance, gladly live at your lofty breast. No sanctions cease unending praise. Where is your single name not glorious? An interesting thing in a couple of Inhedwana's poems to Inanna, she writes specifically how Inanna is the guardian of the opposites. In this one, she says, to mingle the brute, the strong, the downtrodden, the weak, are yours, Inanna. This is what you do. To intermix high ground, low-lying pools, peaks, rolling plains, are yours, Inanna. And then one last section, a very beautiful section of this poem, which is incredibly long and sort of like a theology of what this, of Sumerian religion in a way. Inanna was such an important goddess in that religion. She says, your godliness, like Nanna the moon and Utu the sun, shines forth in the holy sky. Your torch flames heaven's four quarters, spreads splendid light in the dark. And then this kind of puzzling piece. Those warrior women, like a single thread, come forth from beyond the river, do common work in devotion to you, whose hands sear them with purifying fire. Your many devoted who will be burnt like sun-scorched fire bricks pass before your eyes. Now that, to me, is an example of what my client working on that huge snake, it's like that work, that devotion process. She says, you have realized the queen of heaven and earth to the utmost. You hold everything entirely in your hands. I got interested in Inanna, goodness, 10 or 15 years ago. And this, when I first read this poem, it was so shocking because she was so horrible. But I've come to understand her as just the worst kinds of things that can happen to you. That's reality and that belongs too. And there's some way that she presents that whole process as a part of the sacred. So the last thing I want to read you then is another example of I told Peter once that I like happy endings, so this is the happy ending. This is a dream again of another person who's worked to hold this very dark stuff that we carry around. And this is sort of the culminating dream of that process. And this is the dream. I'm in a house with a man and my mother. She sees something, a big bug or spider. My mother says it is too big for her to get and asks the man to kill it or get it out of the house. I look closely and see it is a tarantula. The man is racing around the room chasing it. I say, it won't hurt you. Did you know tarantulas won't hurt you, actually? I heard a lecture once where the man talking about tarantulas says, if you stick your finger in their mouth, they might bite you, but otherwise they're really harmless. They just look horrible. I say, it won't hurt you. He hits at it, and it runs. He tries to pick it up. He'll never catch it, I think to myself. I go to the outside door and open it so that he can shoo the tarantula through. He sweeps it out with a broom. Suddenly, the tarantula begins to fly. Lights come on at the ends of each of its legs. Now the whole thing lights up, tiny lights throughout its body, making an incredible pattern as it flies into the sky. It is dark out, so we can really see it. We watch in amazement. So this dream is like a life story in itself. Its characters are both personal, let's call the woman Claire, her mother, and the trying to be helpful man. And then there's the archetypal, the huge black spider. Knowing the dreamer, I can say the dream is about a menacing, entangling witch-mother complex, a pattern of perception from early childhood that Claire had projected onto women and men and situations alike. And you know what that would look like, that everything looked like that black spider that was out to devour her. The actors in the dream each play a part. The mother, that is the part of the dreamer which is most tied to the old perceptions, wants to get rid of the spider, to kill it, split it off, and get rid of it completely. This represents her old attitude of attempting to separate herself from the painful flaws in her relationship with her actual mother. Claire in the dream, the dreamer's ego, has integrated a new attitude. She is not afraid of the tarantula. She knows it will not harm them, and she does not want it to be hurt. She facilitates getting it out of the house, where it does not naturally belong in the house. For Claire to come to a place in her psychic development where she values the life of the tarantula and wants to protect it is an enormous achievement, that, like the other woman coming to the point where the snake is sliced up and being barbecued. The unknown man in the dream is a willing, bumbling male helper who responds to both women, but finally believes Claire that the tarantula is not harmful and carefully sweeps it out the door. Now the spider flies away in all its glory. The spider, an archetypal pattern that held the dreamer in its negative grip for so many years, has been transformed. The tarantula shows itself to be a magical creature sparkling with light. The light of consciousness Claire brought to this complex day after day in tedious analytical work finally has transformed this shadowy presence into a spider goddess who responds to her careful tending by an apotheosis in the heavens. She, the spider, is out of the dreamer's house and now looks down on Claire like a constellation in the night sky. And we can kind of get an image of why the constellations had such a numinous draw for people always. The dream portrays the new alignment in a woman who has passed through and gone beyond the underworld. The dreadful hold of the tarantula, or the negative mother complex that infiltrated her personal life, bending and twisting her emotions and perceptions until she could hardly move, now shines down on her with benevolent wisdom. The tarantula was her fate and her destiny. She could have broken under it and lived an embittered life even into old age. But through the work and work and work and work on it, the image did transform. So in that way, it was her destiny in that it gave her, you know, new life. Only through Claire's struggle with it could she find her own essential nature underneath that spidery grip. The tarantula is a form of the self, which taught her with painful lessons the reality of life's dark and light aspects. Okay, so the task then for us in the new age, I think, is to integrate and hold as much as we can in this. It's our job. We have the psyches that we have. We have the fate and the destiny that we have. And there's something very important about all of you, all of us, interested in Jung's psychology, because this is just the essence of what Jung was talking about, showing us that it is possible to take even the worst kinds of fates and the most awful inner wounds and pain, and through that kind of burning, searing fire of purification or work, hard work in what, however you do it, there can, you know, you can transform your own piece of dirt, whatever it is. So now we'll take a little break.
Yeah, take a 15-minute break.
A 15-minute break, okay. So we can just talk, and maybe you have questions or thoughts or... Yes. I translated them with the help of a person who knows Sumerian. Well, thank you. Thank you very much. I got Inanna is Do you know about the Sumerian literature or anything? Or, yeah. Sometime in the late 70s, at one of these horrible dark periods, I had a dream that had I wasn't planning to tell you this, but I'll go ahead and tell you. There was these two people had died, and in the dream they were people I knew, and actually both were Jungian analysts. In the dream they were married, actually they weren't married. And some women, which included me and I, were preparing their graves. And one of the woman of the couple had already died, and so we had put these tall wooden kind of stick structures on her grave that curved around into a circle at the top, like a shepherd's crook, only it went all the way around in the circle. And also some palm fronds all wrapped up in a bundle on her grave. The man was dying, and he was instructing us how to prepare his grave and said we were to do it exactly the same, and we did. And there was a little more to the dream. But so I couldn't, of course, I had no idea what those symbols, what that thing was on the grave. And literally months later, I was reading in Neumann's book, The Great Mother, which some of you may know that book, and I came across a picture, and there was that figure of this thing, of the circle at the top and the long stick. And it said that it was an emblem of the mother goddess. In the Neumann book, it just said that. And it referred, the picture had been taken from a book by Rachel Levy called The Gate of Horn. And I tried to find that book. It wasn't in, I was at the Jung Institute in Los Angeles at the time. It wasn't in that library, and it wasn't in print. And somebody suggested writing to England for it. So I wrote to England for this book, and sure enough, one day it came. And Rachel Levy is interesting. She was an archaeologist before World War II, and this book is wonderful. It should be a bestseller, and I think it is now back in print. But she was the first author that I know of who really, as a real trained scientist, went back and traced the images of the feminine through archaeological digs and finds, country by country, and just beautiful work. And her work was stopped during the war, and then she wrote this book later, probably after the war. So I looked up this picture, and that symbol is the way you write Inanna's name in cuneiform script. And it's a picture of the originally cuneiform. You know, the Sumerians invented writing, really. I mean, lots of cultures invented writing, but the Sumerians, it caught on for some reason. And it became the first writing that was used in economics and literature and in the whole, in the way that we use writing today. It was the first script that developed over hundreds of years to be full enough to carry literature. If you think about it, that's hard for us to imagine. But anyway, the very original cuneiform script was pictographic, completely pictographic and symbolic. A certain symbol was the symbol of a sheep. And it was all, originally it was economic text. The reason they had the script was to say, I sent you four sheep, and there would be a little clay tablet with four marks of it on a sheep so that whoever received it was like a bill of lading. As the language developed, by the first tablets that we have were discovered in Uruk, modern-day Warka in Iraq, and they had like 700 different signs and they were discovered in the Inanna Temple in Uruk. And on these tablets with the 700 signs, this was in about 3300 BC, was this image of the pole with the circle on the top. And that symbol also, because it was her name, it carried this power, you know, so that it, in other aspects of the iconography, Inanna's symbol will stand like in a field with the sheep or whatever, and there's that symbol, and that means the goddess is present. So that's how I got interested in Inanna, and because, I don't know why, I just got very, very interested in the language and wanted the... Well, I'll tell you why. I hadn't planned to go into all of this, but I had never heard of Inanna. This is just an example of just, you know, how something pops into your head in a dream. And I mean, if I hadn't found that picture, I would never have ever had any idea that that's what that was. I wasn't even looking for it in a way. I mean, you know, it was a puzzle, but I mean, how all kinds of funny things appear in your dreams. So after I found out it was Inanna from Rachel Levy's book, I started trying to find more out about her and look up her mythology and things like that. Well, the first, I was taking that magazine called Parabola at the time. Maybe some of you know Parabola. And the Sumerian scholar Samuel Noah Kramer had written an article in Parabola, and he's the man who wrote with Diane Wachstein the wonderful book of Inanna's poetry, Inanna, Queen of Heaven and Earth. And there was Samuel Noah Kramer, this, you know, 75-year-old, I think of him as a dusty guy in a library at the University of Pennsylvania, and he was, these poems were written to Inanna's vulva. And I said, what? You know, this is sacred literature, you know. And there was just this whole series of beautiful poems from the sacred marriage ritual where Inanna is praising her private parts and inviting her husband, Dumuzi, in. So I think that's probably what I said. I've got to see this in the original. What does it really say? You know, because Kramer is he's a wonderful translator, and he did most of the work on Inanna. But I just thought, oh, here's this old guy. What does he know about women and, you know? So I was living in Southern California at the time, and I found a graduate student at UCLA who would help me with the translation. And we first did these wonderful poems about Inanna's vulva. Some of them, I think, are in that book. And then, I got hooked on Sumerian, and then I found in Haidawana by hook and by crook, and her work is just really real. It was just so exciting to work on the poetry of a real live person, and not just, I mean, the mythology is wonderful and delicious, but it was just, it felt like rescuing in Haidawana from obscurity to find her poems and do those translations. That's a long answer to your question. Yes?
Now, with the constellation changes then, it's about 2,000 years ago, you say it changed to the house of Pisces that it's in now. And about that time, in that same region, the cult of Isis and, you know, Horus and Osiris and all the cults of the sun and the Roman Empire and so forth took hold. You know, when you talk about the symbolism of the constellation, but I'm wondering what the significance, I mean, you know, all kinds of good explanations, I suppose, you know, of, you know, moon as predominant light, and sun as predominant light in the sky. What would that have to do, though, with the shift in the star constellation? you know, what is the connection there? If, I mean, maybe you think.
I probably don't. I don't quite understand your question. If,
well, isn't there a shift also of emphasis on the body of light?
Oh, from the moon to the constellations, yes.
Well, from the moon to the sun, actually.
Yeah.
I mean, it sounds that way, although perhaps...
Yes, I see what you're saying, yeah.
By the time the Greeks were writing, and that was, you know, 2000 BC, the consciousness had already shifted over to solar.
To solar.
Yeah. At least the millennium had passed over before that. And that makes sense, because as Aries fights the Aquarius, and Aries is, you know, the masculine symbol.
That's as much as I know. Yeah, that's right. I mean, that the there are lots of myths about how the moon became the lesser light. And
right. But it's not necessarily related to the millennium change.
No, I don't think so. No. Yes. 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 Yeah, is it a woman or a man? That's a good question. Because there's, or both. Or maybe it's an androgynous figure. Yeah. The interesting thing about Aquarius, I think, whereas Pisces, you know, I those two fish are so far apart. It's a wonder that they were even seen as one constellation. It's so obviously two sides of something. But Aquarius is like this human figure with the vessel, a very contained, structured human person holding this vessel that the water is slowly pouring out of. It's not like an ocean, a tidal wave or a deluge. It's just this very quiet pouring out of the water. It does feel very feminine, really, the whole image of pouring the water out of the vessel. But I think he's usually looked at as a man. But I've seen that, too, where it was a woman.
And isn't Aquarius, anybody who knows more astrology, isn't that a near sign, not a water sign, but a near sign?
Yes, I think that's right.
Sometimes I think that it's like electricity instead of water.
Ah, that's interesting. Okay.
Is the projection on Pisces splitting, then is there a similar, or what would be the corresponding projection on Aries?
Well, I think what Jung says is that it's about integration of the split, or that it, and it, as I said, it seems important that he doesn't say that's what's going to happen in the next 2,000 years, but that is the problem we'll be struggling with, is the integrating those two very opposite energies. And it's just interesting to me that really, just in this century, have we understood psychologically about the process of psychological splitting and how to help ourselves integrate what we split. You know, I mean, it's just all so synchronistic that's happening here, this final year, the final decade before the millennium. Anybody else?
I'm curious where the projection of the pictures that you put out, where the constellation information came from, where those pictures came from.
They came from a book that's almost like a children's book, or at least it explains the constellations and the precession of the equinox in a way that I can understand it. It's actually written by an astronomer. It's an old book. I don't even know if it's still... It's a very old book. Do you know that book?
I
had
this book as a child.
Yes.
That, it's not that old.
Is it new enough that we remember his name?
I know the author's name is R.E.Y., Ray something. I meant to stick it in my suitcase, but I just forgot. I sort of panicked when I realized I didn't have it. But is it still in print? Oh, I'm glad to see that because I really wanted to send it to my grandchildren. It's a wonderful book. It's the only book I can understand. I can't remember the name of it, but it's a paperback, kind of about this size, and it's blue, and it has that cartoon. It has, in fact, Gemini on the cover, the twins. Yes.
So, at the beginning of your introduction, you were talking about this, the shift in the 16th century from vertical to horizontal, and what came to mind quickly was Northrop Frye's explanation of that same period when there was a shift, an opposite shift. In other words, instead of looking higher as to the ascendant purification, the shift started to look below, to nature, to descent, where our ideas of imagination, the romantic, so that it wasn't so much the horizontal but a reversal. And it just struck me that there were different ways, you know. I mean, he wasn't looking at Pisces, so he didn't see a horizontal movement. What he saw was a reversal. And but that still, I thought, is significant because this is now the age, you know, 300 or 400 years now when we started thinking in terms of these archaeological layers of history of psyche. You know, so I thought his imagery really explains just as much as the horizontal.
It does. It seems very pertinent.
Yeah.
That it goes away from the spirit up in the sky to the...
But in a way it's very positive because, it points again to the descent and the willingness to look to the...
Yes.
...nature and darkness. So... I don't know, that somehow the horizontal movement as being non-spiritual may be, a one-sided view.
Right.
Possibly. Although I agree with him, he feels that's essential that we go through this and then a non-spiritual movement that will then return to, the spiritual.
Yes. But it certainly was a movement down into nature and trying to understand nature through science.
Yeah.
There's also a fundamental split between the divine as defined by spirit and the divine as defined by matter. The soul being a symbol or the intersection of the two.
Right.
And as long as one lives within a cosmology and philosophy that says spirit good, matter bad, masculine good, feminine bad, then to enter into the feminine, that which is matter, that which is natural, so-called, is a descent. And the great, one of the great challenges, in fact, what was it, 300 or something like that, the Catholic Church said, up to that point, there were three areas of divinity. There was spirit, there was matter, mother, and the intersection was the soul. And the soul was that intersection,
was the Christ in each of us that united and like Hermes could go across. And the Catholic Church said, oh no, no soul. What we have is spirit split and we have matter. And so to re-enter, to go into Inanna, into the depths, and to find the epiphany or the divine in something that is not spiritual is the great, is one of the great acts of reintegration.
Yeah. That's well stated, our task for the millennia.
One of the ships, too, that astrologically is between Pisces. Pisces is, the symbol is the two fish, you know, and they sort of light and dark. It is not Tao symbol, unfortunately. There is no integration, and yet there's a wholeness. It's circles. And people who are Pisces have a very difficult time knowing if they're coming or going, if they're good or bad, or wholesome.
Yes, well said.
And I think in the age of Pisces, you could have monks. You could have people who say, all I need to do is sit here and hear and meditate. And you're now in an age where that's just not going to cut it.
Yeah.
Francis is a much better teacher. And he's a better
We all are feeling those changes, boy. Yes.
I have a question about the practical work of quite a rough symbol of a snake. And so often trying to bring forward these horrific images that come mentioned a little bit out of the layer. I'm wondering just if you had any to say about what to do with those images when they come forward, when the client is so terrified and almost feels overwhelmed by the moment. How do you deal with that? You can't make a generalization.
No, I think, you know, you would treat it the way you would a kid who has a nightmare, you know, that you just try to, if the person is feeling that overwhelmed, as my client was when she had the nightmare of the yellow and black snake, that it's, you know, you just try to provide a holding space just to hold the person to, and the unfolding, the unraveling of that is takes so long with some people that, you know, you can be very patient and you don't feel like you have to get the points across. Mostly it's just trying to help the person not be overwhelmed. Yeah, yeah. Are you a therapist?
I think so.
It's a good way to put it. Yes. I haven't, but I want to. It sounds like a wonderful book.
It talks about humanizing the archaic energy, and in some sense, that there's a little bit about that adjusting and
that's right.
Humanize.
That's right. She had, through that long period and process, humanized.
Right.
Yeah. So that it's edible food, and humans can eat it, and it can be nourishing. I'm amazed at how many people, and this particular woman with that dream had just a horrendous, horrendous wounds, just dreadful.
It's also interesting because he talks about,
mm-hmm.
But because very often those traumatic instances happen early in life, but I was interested in your mentioning the brain too, and the development of the brain, and why sometimes maybe it's difficult to integrate because of the actual physiology.
Yeah.
At the time of the trauma.
That's right. That's right. Yeah. So that those very early infant wounds are just the greatest, and that's the kind she had. But I think you also see people who haven't had that terrible wounding, who have sturdier feet on the ground in reality, still having these horrendous, like, visions and dreams, and maybe that's always been true. I always think, gosh, this is all millennium stuff or something, that this is happening now. Beth?
One of the things that I, along those lines that I've wondered about is that in a few people that I've worked with, those people who don't want to deal with the dark side, who really want the world to be only wonderful,
mm-hmm.
sometimes have the most horrendous dreams.
Yes, yes.
And
yeah.
I kind of wanted to make that a generalization, but I'm curious about it, because it seems as though the more repressed those images and feelings and attitudes and whatever are, they come out. There's a pressure for them.
Yes. The one instance I'm thinking of, that was exactly the case. A woman who had meditated for years and years and years and was really a fairly steady person, fairly grounded, and then this stuff just started, you know, overwhelming her. These were like visions, and she was a completely, shall I say, normal, you know, go to work in the morning kind of person, and this started happening. And it did make it rang a bell that because of all the meditation and trying to get rid of all the dark and live in the light, that for her fate, that just wasn't to be, that she had to have the other side, and it was horrendous.
For individuation?
Yes, for her own individuation, that's right. And we each have a different hold on, different spot on the thread. We each have a different thread, you know. It's just so important to know what your thread is and what your job is, I think. You know, that your job to me is to integrate as much of that stuff as you can, because for many, many reasons, but one of them being is that it takes it out of circulation. You don't pass it down, you know. Yeah. You don't pass it on. You've done your job, you know, I think.
Well, I think that you spoke of dreams as having a compensatory function.
Mm-hmm.
That's very much.
Very much, yeah. Yeah. I noticed you're having a woman doing authentic movement next time, and there's another book by a woman, and I'm just terrible at remembering these names. called Arching Backwards. It's by a woman who's very competent doing authentic movement. But it's really a series of her images and visions that are like this. I mean, just the most horrendous things you can imagine. And the process of the integration of that. Yes.
It's interesting that the woman had to meditate, because, I mean, that is theoretically what happens after years of meditation, but without a proper teacher or guide, which is what she sounds she was lacking.
Yeah.
Which is maladaptation to some of these Eastern techniques. Kundalini yoga, I guess it's the Shamanini.
Kundalini, what?
Yeah. But a new book came out recently, all of his lectures on yoga, and he warned people, you know, he was good at warning Westerners not to adapt totally to Eastern techniques. But when people first started practicing yoga, all these warnings came out, oh, you'll go absolutely crazy, you'll go absolutely insane, and, you know, people were dragged up, you know, hysterically. But just sort of this, you know, orientalizing, if you will, of the dark side, you know.
Yes.
And then to project that onto Eastern meditative techniques or whatever, I mean, that even Jung was, you know, sucked into that to a certain extent.
Yeah. We've learned so much in the last 20 years about how Westerners can use those techniques.
With full appreciation sometimes.
Yeah.
Just to mimic.
Yes.
Do you know how the worship of
the worship?
Her as how did that all come to
be?
How
did she perform? Oh. What? They were, but she continued as a goddess even in the Babylonian times. And she was a goddess all the way almost to the first century A.D. from like probably 4,000 B.C., you know, for 4,000 years. And she certainly had her ups and downs. A big, you know, with the shift... The pantheon, the Sumerian pantheon, became more and more masculine, and even some of the goddesses became gods with the same name, but would become male. And I can't tell you historically, but my guess is that some historical event happened around 400 B.C., where that whole society was conquered or wiped out or something, and that was the end, the last that she was heard of. But she lasted a very long time through many permutations of the culture and different kings and different countries ruling. She was very influential in the ancient Near East.
Betty, I forgot. Would you say a few words on what you're going to do tomorrow in the workshop? There's still a little bit of room so that maybe some...
Yes, okay. The structure of the workshop is going to be around Jung's stages of individuation. The three, actually, we'll concentrate on two main stages of individuation, and talk about, you know, more about holding the opposites and looking at the inanimate material, because that's very important in the stages of individuation. And the main focus will be on bringing the spirit back into the body and what that, rather than perpetuating the split of the spirit outside, what it means for the spirit and the soul to be back inside the body, and how you do that. That's what we'll talk about. I don't know how you do that, but that's what we'll talk about. I guess it's time for us to stop. Yes, okay.
And that is the end of the tape. Copyright CGU and Society, Seattle, and the speaker. All rights reserved. No copying, please.